Hi, Donald. Welcome to EarHex FM.
Great to be here.
What was your first computer?
My first computer was an Epson HX20, which I believe was the world's first laptop, if I'm not mistaken. And I taught myself how to program in BASIC in it.
Wow. I think you're the first guest with an Epson computer. Never heard about that. There's an Epson printers, but computers?
I had Epson printers for many years. I think it was an Epson MX80. Mm-hmm. Dot matrix printer was quite popular for many years. I had that with an old Apple-compatible computer mm-hmm. head. But yeah, Epson, they weren't well-known for computers, but they had an app laptop that came out. I think it was in like 1981 or 82. That puts a okay. age on myself. But that was literally my first computer.
And it was a laptop?
It was a laptop. So it had a tiny LCD screen. It was probably like, it could fit four or five lines of text on it max. But it was kind of neat that you could actually, you could program in BASIC on it. It also had, assembly language, which I never taught myself that back when I was, very young. But you could actually draw pixels on the screen as well. So you could do some amount of graphics. I think it... it was funny, if you've ever seen the movie War Games, I had an acoustic coupler modem for it that mm-hmm. you'd actually plug the...
With the rubber.
Exactly. With the rubber, you'd actually put the handset into the thing, which was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the laptop? I have to look it up. Because
it's Epson HX-20. So if you Google that, you'll find links, but you'll see images of it. It's a cute little laptop.
Wow, it is, you can still... buy it on eBay.
Honestly, that was something. I wish I had kept that laptop. I sold uh-huh. it to a friend when I went to university.
And he so how much used, can you buy it? Say it.
I don't know how much it's going for now.
219.
I don't know. I would buy that worth the money if it worked.
But it looks really good. I would say the keyboard looks like a mechanical keyboard right now. And HX20 or HC20, I never saw. And this is actually a small one. This is great. I thought it is huge.
No, it is. Once again, it literally the world's first laptop, and you could actually fit it on your lap. Now, it's interesting because the one I had an expansion port for memory, which went off on the side, and also had a built-in printer. Looks like something you'd get at like a retail store or something, that prints out the receipts and stuff mm-hmm. or like an old calculator that had printers. But it was a great piece of equipment and a great thing to learn on.
Interesting. It says the later most popular TRS-80 from Radio Shack designed by Kyocera was a similar design to the HX-20. So but to the listeners, you really have to look it up because it looks almost like a modern mechanical keyboard. It looks like a Keychron or something like this keyboard. So it looks perfect. And if you search for it, there's even an ad, handheld computer HX, but this is 20. And this is in German. I saw it. This is by maybe Lufthansa, looks like. Lufthansa did... this was a German, it says, it is like paper sheet. So in Germany, we have A4 format. It says, this is actually the most amazing machine. Yeah, if you think about this, it is smaller than MacBook Air.
It is, because the screen itself is right above the keyboard, right? So it is tiny.
I see a picture. It is like... in German, interestingly, and this is looks like a Lufthansa ad. Never saw this. The home computer guy, and this is a woman, Lufthansa woman. It helps in with should be light in one yeah. hand the computer, and it had battery, akku, after 5 minutes, I completely was amazed at this.
Well, it's funny. I mean, there's a Wikipedia entry for it, so if you look at that, and actually has the picture too with the printer that I talked about with the rolls of paper. I mean, once again, kicking myself for selling this thing to my friend because, and you can see it actually had the micro cassette tape as well. You could actually store on it. It was an amazing piece of equipment.
And it looks good.
Yeah.
That's the interesting part.
Yeah, you'd look at it today and say, like, hey, this doesn't look so.
Yeah, I would say today, if we would replace the screen or just chop off the screen and, you know, provide an external monitor, I would say it would be absolute up to date. So nothing, right? I mean, it looks like mechanical keyboard. This is what it is.
So, but yeah,
and it's the first portable computer. You're absolutely right.
There you have it.
Yeah, but I had similar experience. I had I don't know how I got it, but it was later. An Olivetti computer, a laptop. It was also tiny. It was. It had a black-white LCD monitor screen, and there was nothing on it because I think I had to run DOS. It had already a diskette, but it was also a tiniest. It was smaller than the netbooks later. Hmm. It was also amazing. I don't know how I got it. It was used, but it was amazing. So usually I ask the question what you did with the computer, but I think there were no games on it, so maybe chess or something. But
no, it was it's funny because there were no games. Once again, I had BASIC built in to the computer, and I remember trying to actually build games on my own back in the day. And
what did you try to achieve? Because, you know, the LCD screen is just like a calculator screen, more or less.
Yeah, it's funny because the first thing I remember building on it in BASIC was, go figure, I'm 11 years old, wrote a program to calculate overtime pay, right? It's you work a certain number of hours, over 40, you get time and a half, just something simple to do that, right? So, that was the idea I got in my head to do. I don't know why. I can't recall. It's quite a while ago now, but but I do remember also trying to, draw things on the screen to, kind of do some, game development. But, I think it was too early in my days to really understand how to do that efficiently. It would have taken me a lot of time. So I spent a lot more time, thankfully, going out and riding bikes. I lived in Vermont at the time. So, riding bikes, skiing, hiking, swimming, a lot of probably too much playing of Atari 2600 games as well. So I was inspired.
2600. I only know Atari 800. Is this 2600 a larger one or?
No, it's smaller. So it was really like a targeted, I guess, gaming console. I think Atari 800, you could actually program on that one. That one was came with a keyboard, right?
Yeah. The 800 XL, what I remember.
Yeah.
XC64, similar, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the 800, if I'm not mistaken as well, might have been able to play the 2600 games, but the games were somewhat better. I definitely had a friend who had an 800. I remember playing on it. But the 2600 was like your typical, before we had, Nintendo or, Sega or, Sony. It's like it was like your cartridge-based system. Mm-hmm. All you can do is plug in a cartridge and you have the controllers, right? And the famous, I would say one of the most famous games on it was Pitfall.
I remember the name. What was the Pitfall about? What was it?
It was basically you had this, it was a 2D scrolling game where you had this guy who had to jump over swing on vines over alligators or lakes and try and pick up gold or silver or diamonds, right? And
Aztecs, so the what? It was like I remember that you have to swing and there were crocodiles.
Yeah, and they
something.
Actually, it's funny because years later, they did a reboot, and I remember having it on. It's funny because I had a history of gaming consoles, and I still have a bunch of them, in storage around my house. I still have my wife's actual old 2600, and we actually they rebooted the 2600. You can actually buy it today. And the key thing about it was back in the day when you buy a 2600, your options to hook it up to a TV were somewhat limited, and you would be hard pressed to find that kind of connectivity today. But the reboot, the key thing about it plays the old games, but what it does is actually allows you to plug into HDMI, right, as your output. So I think it was in Sega Genesis or maybe, so one of my favorite gaming systems, which was the first 64-bit gaming platform, was Atari Jaguar. There was a reboot of Pitfall called Pitfall Mayan Adventure, and it was more modern graphics. The original Pitfall was goofy when you looked at it and had some great, sound to the game and whatnot. And this really, earworm-like song that played through the thing. So, but the reboot was kind of neat, you know, as a more modern game, you know, I believe it was still a 2D scroller, but just much better graphics. But there was an Easter egg in the game where if you found this one place in the game, it would actually jump you into the original pitfall. Mm-hmm. So you could actually play the original Atari 2600 pitfall inside of the Pitfall Mayan Adventure, which was great, right? I loved that homage to the original. It was good fun. So
for unknown reasons, what I remember right now is Montezuma's Revenge game.
Yes, I remember that. It's funny because I want to say I played that on the old Apple II, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, what I see is also Wikipedia entry. I remember the title. I don't know whether I played it, but I, as you mentioned, Pitfall was the crocodiles. For unknown reasons, I just remember they... And it was Apple II, Atari 2600, and now I see how it looked like. Okay, I saw this already. Atari 5200, and yep. Commodore, IBM PC, Master System, and ZX Spectrum. It was called Panama Joe. Wow. Okay, so you started with the Epson, and
After the Epson, I for many years I had a people may not remember this, but like there was an Apple clone. So it was an Apple II clone. It was actually this company called Franklin. And they made the Franklin Ace. I think it was 1000, and they got sued out of existence by Apple, if I'm not mistaken. But created an Apple clone. I had one of these, right? And I had Apple hard drives, but I used Apple for many years all through high school. It was like another, you know, place where I learned how to program. And I had all manner of, you know, different, you know, things on. I actually ran a bulletin board system back in the 80s with it.
But you learned on the Epson BASIC. And then
that's where I learned BASIC. Yeah. So I did with the Apple though, like, were quite popular.
What you did on the Epson? So what was like, you know, the biggest achievement of the Epson and how you got the Apple? So I know what was the transition?
So on the Epson, I would say it was probably that, you know, the overtime pay calculator that I wrote was probably my biggest achievement that I can remember. With the, you know, the Apple, what was nice was Apples became quite popular in the United States in schools. So we had access to Apple II computers. Apple IIe, I think, was the most common variety. Occasionally, you'd see Apple IIc. Mm-hmm. And I got to learn things like, if I recall correctly, there was a logo we had on Apple, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely like BASIC was something I did a lot more BASIC programming on the Apple, right? Because you'd boot up the Apple, you'd get the command prompt and, you know, away you go, you know, with programming. I can't recall much of what I programmed on Apple though. You know, I would say like I got more into like playing games and everything on the Apple. And it's funny because I was recalling as we were talking about, you know, Pitfall and whatnot, like one of my favorite games was the Ultima series. If you've ever heard of it. No. So it was like Ultima 1 through, I'm not sure how far it went. I definitely played up through Ultima 4, but it was a scrolling adventure game. Yeah, it was just, I would say like it was kind of like a prequel maybe to something like Diablo, which I, you know, later in my, you know, when I had PCs and, you know, would do games on there. Diablo is probably the game I spent the most time playing. Thankfully, I played Warcraft, the original ones, but I never got into World of Warcraft. But I played Diablo up through, you know, Diablo 2. I played Diablo 3, but I never finished that one. Diablo 1 and 2, though, I finished. And I think, I want to say, was it from 2 to 3? Like, I had to wait 10 years for Diablo 3 to come out.
Whoa.
Like there was a 10, and which is crazy when you think in like, you know, time frames, right, of things, like 10 years to wait for a new game to come out. And when it came out, unfortunately, I was like, had a Sony Vaio laptop that I bought expecting that Diablo 3 was going to come out. And it was delayed by 2 or 3 years when I bought the laptop. And by the time the game came out, the game required better hardware than I had. I had to basically play Diablo 3 with like all the lowest settings on graphics and whatnot for it to even be playable. So
you're a hardcore gamer.
I at one point in my life, maybe. No, not anymore.
No. Okay.
Usually now it's like something goofy on a phone. I like Clash Royale on my phone, which is like a tower defense game. right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting because my son has gotten a lot more into, you know, more modern gaming. So he'll play things like Fortnite and, you know, mm-hmm. played Destiny for many years. But I think he just upgraded to Grand Theft Auto.
Back then, you played more or you programmed? Where we spend more time?
Well, it depends on when back then. Obviously, like, I would say really hardcore into programming through high school and then through, you know, university. And obviously, like, you know, then started my career. I had learned a bunch of programming languages when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Everything including...
So what came after BASIC?
Pascal. Mm-hmm. Also Fortran and COBOL.
At high school?
Yeah, in high school.
It's a crazy high school you.
Well, it wasn't high school. I was actually taking some classes and some programming classes in college at the mm-hmm. time. So it was like there I was able to take, you know, Fortran and COBOL.
So you were at high school and you were in parallel. You also went to college?
I took some college classes, yeah. It was really, if you wanted to learn programming, it was the place you would have to go. We didn't have, you know, the internet back then. I couldn't just Google programming. It's like getting access to programming languages. It's like, yeah, high school, I had Pascal. I could do BASIC. We had Logo, but that was pretty much the extent of it, right? So,
but why you wanted to do that? Because as I understand, you were in Vermont and you could go outside.
Well, I moved to New Jersey.
Oh, this was the reason. Okay.
Yeah. So, but when a... Yeah, it's interesting because I really got, you know, interested in programming, and I started as well. Like once I got a PC, which mm-hmm. was in the late 80s, I got access to some, you know, additional programs. So there was like Turbo, you know, Prolog, which, okay. you know, I guess was like originally, you know, from Borland, if anybody mm-hmm. remembers that company.
But I didn't add a JBuild a lot. But Turbo Prolog, never heard about it. Turbo Pascal, of course. But
I'm sorry. It's funny because I said Turbo Prolog. I meant Turbo Pascal. The reason I said Turbo Prolog, sorry, I got ahead of myself. I picked up Turbo Prolog as well in the 80s. So that came out in like 1986. And I got, you know, access to Turbo Prolog, which was like, you know, at the time, this was before, you know, I had, you know, graduated high school and whatnot. So teaching myself Turbo Prolog, that was like a little bit outlandish, right? It's like, yeah. you know, Pascal and Fortran and COBOL were like one thing, right? And BASIC as well. Prolog was like a completely different animal to be learning, right? So
beginnings of AI a little bit, right? In Prolog, wasn't it like...
Yes. So it was, you know, the beginnings in some ways of AI. I would say like AI owes its probably heritage, you know, combination of languages like Lisp and Prolog. I didn't get to do any Lisp though until university.
Mm-hmm. And why you did it? Why are you so interested? What was your goal? To you want to program something, achieve something? Are you fascinated with whatever, science fiction, or what was actually the idea?
So why was the motivation? I like just being able to like create and solve problems.
But why in five languages?
I don't know. I found something just intriguing and interesting about the ability to like, you know, control mm-hmm. a computer with like different languages, right? And what the different mm-hmm. approaches and, you know, problems you could solve with it were, right? So it was interesting because another language that I taught myself while I was in high school was actually DBase 3+. Mm-hmm. And I would say that was the most practical thing I learned because I could actually build actual programs mm-hmm. and, you know, used to, you know, build a different, you know, database, you know, applications. Because mm-hmm. with DBase, you know, for folks that aren't familiar with it, DBase was both a programming language, but also had a local database. It was a database management system, right? So you created these things called DBF files, and you had like, you know, it had a data manipulation language, a data definition language. You can create, you know, tables and, you know, DBF file, have indexes and different things, right? And it was like, I would say, like, if I'm recalling correctly, like it was like a row, kind of like row based language. Like you could keep like a cursor in a table. And it was like, it was really good. Cause back then, when you were doing things as well, like you had very limited memory, right? It's not like you could load a lot of stuff in memory. So like you had to have kind of like this, you know, the row-based, cursor-based approach to doing things, right? It's like moving positions through, you know, a table and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. And like there was, you know, simple things like you could do, like summarizing, you know, mm-hmm. data and whatnot. But, you know, in some ways similar, but, you know, probably a lot different than, you know, what most modern programmers would know about, like using something like SQL, right? Completely different data manipulation language. So
how different? So what we will do in DBase to select all rows or one row? What?
It's going to be hard pressed.
just roughly, just to get an idea, I know how it can be different. It's more like you had to like working with JDBC directly without a query, or you know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting because like I can't remember as much about DBase 3+. I did many years. I programmed in another language that was actually called the DBase compiler. It was called Clipper. And with Clipper, there were things that you would use, and I'm trying to remember the actual objects. This is going back to the early 90s. Clipper had a built-in object called, I think it's called T-Browse, if I recall correctly. It's funny,
I found DBase Plus.
There's DBase 3 Plus. I did DBase 4 in university. But you would typically like with, at least in Clipper with T-Browse, what you could do is use T-Browse to basically display the windowed contents of a table. All right. Or the equivalent of a table in Clipper. And it was interesting because like you didn't do things like selecting, like, you know, and filtering down, let's say, mm-hmm. the columns and rows. You could display what you choose, what columns, let's say, you wanted to display mm-hmm. in a table on the screen. And then once again, you would set a specific position in mm-hmm. Effectively like a cursor mm-hmm. in SQL to figure out what row you wanted to look at. And then you would actually, you know, either query or update, you know, things.
Almost like JDBC, right? Result set and.
A little bit, yeah. So it was, once again, you get this very programmatic, you had basically, instead of, where SQL is like kind of like its own standalone thing, the nice thing with both DBase and Clipper is like you had the data manipulation language built into the programming language itself. So you could do programming type stuff like managing, let's say, arrays or sorting stuff. But then—
Do you remember SQLJ?
SQLJ.
It was a Java project. It looked like JSPs for SQL. And it was, I think, from Sun Microsystems, because it sounds almost like SQLJ was the name.
I'm just Googling it. It's an ISO standard for embedded static SQL statements. I remember the name, but I never used it.
It was Java and SQL, Oracle Compaq, Informix, Sybase, and Cloudscape, and Sun Microsystems. And it was like Pro C in Oracle back then. And it looks like JSP, so you could embed SQL into your text. And it's also a Wikipedia entry, so we'll put it to the show notes. I remember I did some for clients, some proof of concepts, but
Well, it's interesting. I just Googled as well, like looking and see if there, I recall someone doing this, like, and it looks like there's still a project out on GitHub for it called JDBF, which would allow you to access DBF files from Java. Mm-hmm. So it's a library for that. It hasn't been updated in 8 years. So I can't testify to the how good it is or not, but like you might be able to see, like, you know, how things.
After publishing the episode, the listeners will port, you know, the JDBF to Epson.
Okay, I'll buy that. $10. That's what I'm going to willing to spend.
But SQLJ, I have to. This was actually interesting idea back then. I forgot where I wanted to do this, but or had to do this. But I remember what I did prior to this. There was similar standard for Oracle database. So you could embed SQL to C, and there was a preprocessor or post-processor, and it created, like JSPs, the C or C++ code, and SQLJ was similar back then. And it's an interesting piece. It's also an old one. And was Clipper related to DBase?
Yeah, so Clipper was a compiler. So DBase was interpreted, right? So start up the DBase interpreter and would basically then run. You could store programs, and I think they were called PRG files, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And basically, like, you could run those within the DBase interpreter. With Clipper, what you had is it was more like C in some ways, where effectively, like, you have a compiler and a linker. Mm-hmm. And it was, if I recall correctly, it was a P code compiler, but you could then actually link and create executables, right? They ran on DOS. So it was a DOS based programming language. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. I remember fondly the linker that I used. I can still remember the name of it. It was called Blinker. And it was a commercial product that came out for Clipper. And there was actually a great third party, tooling and library space for Clipper. But Blinker was cute because, like, when you started up, it basically had that ASCII art that basically the art was animated. It would actually blink at you as it was linking. Thus the name Blinker, right? So, but you'd basically, like, do make files, for all your PRG files to compile them, right? And then you'd use Blinker to link them up.
I wanted actually to ask about Clipper and DBase relation earlier, because a few years before pandemic, I had an interesting project, and a developer from back then became a CTO of a company, and they created mission critical software on Clipper. Hmm. And then they got new Windows version, and the Clipper was no more supported, so it couldn't run. Because
the Windows version was Visual Objects? Because I have books on that behind me. Sorry.
So the company, there was a bigger company, was forced to update the Windows operating system, and this Windows didn't support the Clipper anymore. And for unknown reasons, there were PL1 developers right now and AS400, and they asked me to help them to port this to Java.
Okay.
And this was like almost mission impossible, because I had no idea what Clipper is doing, and they had no idea about Java. And I wanted to write Java in this way that they will understand what I did. So it means there were basically, I couldn't use, not sophisticated, just objects. I just basically implemented everything with interfaces and static methods. So, like, a procedural style, which worked. And we also used Excel for testing. So they had the calculations in Excel, and we read Excel. But the interesting part is it worked extremely well, because the guy back then still remembered what he did, years ago, exactly knew what's going on. And he basically dictated, and I wrote the Java code, and we got the test data in Excel, and we were done in 2 weeks. The interesting part is they said, okay, this project is not that nice, because it's not nicely documented with diagrams, and there's no UML and stuff like that. And they a consulting company tried to implement this from scratch. And they stopped after a few years, and they couldn't, because the guy was missing. The business logic was not there. So they try, to investigate and to gather requirements. But it was really hard, because there was no one who knew the logic. This is why the project failed. That's and funny. This is why I heard Clipper. I remember that. So it was a really interesting project, because in 2 weeks we were done and lots of fun. Yeah.
I was going to say, and you're making me recall all of this interesting stuff in the attics of my memory. So DBase was built by a company called Ashton Tate, if I can recall correctly. Clipper was implemented by a company called Nantucket. Nantucket was later purchased by Computer Associates. Yeah. So Clipper became CA Clipper. They came out with a Windows version, which was called CA Visual Objects. I actually have some old books behind me, because I actually did some CA Visual Objects programming for a few years. That was Windows. It was kind of neat.
Was it different to Clipper? Vastly different? Or was it still the same?
It had similarities, but vastly different. It was like a full, Windows-based kind of programming language. And you could build native Windows executables. It was occasionally highly unstable. Visual Objects had this approach that I later learned and appreciated better, because it was a bit more stable. Visual Objects had this repository-based development approach that I later learned, and used in Smalltalk. So Smalltalk, when you program in Smalltalk, and actually I learned Smalltalk in the mid 90s, like 1994. And I would say like that was after Clipper, like Smalltalk was like the probably biggest, you know, impact in terms of my learning and understanding and appreciation of programming. Well, I learned a lot of stuff before then. I didn't really appreciate the history of programming until I learned Smalltalk. I spent a lot of time like, you know, studying the origins of languages, where they came from and whatnot. But what's interesting is that going back to Clipper and DBase, there was another language that might be more well known, you may recognize the name, is actually FoxPro.
Yes.
So FoxPro, there was a whole series of like what they call them X-based languages, which started with DBase. But FoxPro used the same storage technology, the DBF files, right? They had a separate indexing.
How's possible? Who invented the DBF files? I mean, there should be one company.
So it was Ashton Tate, I think, which, you know, let me Google that to make sure I'm not setting
No, just as the one company did the format and all others used that, right?
Well, and that was, it's funny because they came up with the DBF file format, so the actual data storage, but the indexing format was different. So if I recall correctly, DBase had a extension called NDX. Clipper added their own indexing approach, and their file extension was NTX. And I think FoxPro, I might be wrong on this because I didn't do really much FoxPro. I think there's, I don't know if it was like CDX or something. FoxPro.
So in theory, you can have one data file and FoxPro and all the others accessing the same data file, just reading, right?
Yes. So they could all read DBF files, right? It's really whether you use the indexing. And the indexing, I think, it was more efficiency that you gained, you know, using the different indexing approaches. And what you could actually do with
Clipper... So you CQRS, you know, you had command query segregation back then, right? So you could have...
Sure. I'm going to Google just to make sure I get this correct because I haven't...
So you spend lots of time with FoxPro and DBase and stuff like that?
Yeah, so FoxPro, the extension was CDX. So
CDX,
DBase,
okay.
NDX, Clipper, NTX, FoxPro, CDX. Now your listeners have very useless trivia.
We already covered punch cards and patch tapes.
Okay,
and,
good.
I mean, this is now advanced technology we're talking about, right?
Yes. All right, I'll stop that in terms of DBase and Clipper and, you know, FoxPro. But yeah, FoxPro went on with Microsoft, right? There's Microsoft Visual FoxPro. I don't know if it's still maintained or not, but it was available for many years, right? It was popular.
This is what I wanted to tell, to say that Visual FoxPro and, I never used FoxPro. I only heard about DBase and stuff like that because if someone used DBase or FoxPro back then, they really liked that. And this is why I know it and I still remember, because you were in the early Java projects and we started and they just said, okay, why it doesn't work so well as a DBase? I have no idea what DBase is. and then I understood that it works so well because DBase is the database and the program on one machine. And we were forced to distribute everything. So we had no chance to compete, you know, back then with DBase because the user experience, you couldn't achieve that in a distributed environment. So it is before image, after image, all you know, all the thing you have to deal with, it were not necessary in FoxPro, a single user system, right?
Yep.
The same was true for Microsoft Access later.
Yeah.
The same story. People were really happy and there were architect and or management decisions. We have to migrate away from Access. It was the same story. People were disappointed because, yeah.
Well, and I think that was the great story about, yeah, that category of programming languages that basically had local database access, right? It was so quick and easy to get up and productive because you didn't need to do a relational database install and, you know, then use JDBC drivers or whatever you use to access the database, right? And then, so it's like you had literally just the programming language and data access built into the language.
FileMaker is also similar, I think, right? So it's still around.
FileMaker. Yeah, it's funny because like, there were other languages people may not recognize. Like there was Paradox from Borland.
Yeah. I heard about that one. Was it also DBF compatible, Paradox?
No. Paradox had its own storage, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But
the name
it's
sounds great. This is what I remember. This Paradox is a professional name. You know, FoxPro, we can argue, but Paradox sounds great.
Yeah.
For me, at least.
Well, it's interesting. One thing, you know, and I did so many years of Pascal programming, like in between high school and college, and I never got to use it professionally. every once in a while, I think I probably had a book on it at some stage, like looked at possibly learning Pascal grew into Delphi, which I think is still around in some places.
This I wanted to ask you. Delphi was actually huge, and I wanted to learn Delphi because I also spent some time with Turbo Pascal. I started with Basic, but what I wanted to have was an executable application, which was not available on Basic, or at least not on my machine. And then I asked someone, I say, hey, with Turbo Pascal, you can do it. So I just learned Turbo Pascal in order to have no executable proper applications. And this is how I learned Turbo Pascal. And then someone told me, hey, the real thing is Delphi. It's Turbo Pascal, but object-oriented.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is object-oriented? Because this object orientation sound, I had no idea what it is, but it sounds great. So object orientation, what does mean objects, right? And and then Java happened, so I never had the chance. But I think if Java happened 1 year later, I would be a Delphi, you know, fanboy.
Yeah, it's funny because if I hadn't gone, so I got into Smalltalk programming because I worked in IBM back in the 90s, and IBM had a program called Object Technology University. And I believe I got in, like it was at the, you know, kind of like the prototype class for object technology.
But what interesting, because we have to stop for a second, because you are interesting. So already in high school, you learned almost all languages. Now I'm curious what you did at the university. I mean, what happened then? So what was the trajectory? What you studied? And
university was mostly Pascal, and I did have Lisp. So it was Pascal, I think assembly. Mm-hmm. And Lisp were the three languages.
And you did something aside or just enjoyed, you know, New Jersey?
Well, it's funny because while I was going to college, I was actually consulting as well, doing Clipper programming. So I was actually, that was the way I funded my college, was through, consulting. So, that was kind of it. You know, I obviously kept gaming as well. I think I played way too many hours of SimCity. PC gaming became a thing for me at that point. So, but then, you know, I was in college, so studying and socializing as well.
Okay. And after college?
After college. So it's interesting. All of this stuff, which I'm telling you as well, you can actually, there's a blog where I tell 40 years of my career.
But talking with you is better than reading about, you know.
So I know. We'll talk about it. But if people, you know.
What's the name of the blog?
So it's Joy of Programming. Do Joy of Programming and Donald Robb, you will find, you know, my 40 years of story. And you'll hear everything all the way back to the Epson HX20 story that we told. But I tell the story of where I started. So when I started off my professional career, I started off in healthcare. And I was doing Clipper programming at Blue Cross Blue Shield in New Jersey.
As motivation to the listeners, it is worth reading because you had something to do with collections and Java Lambdas and Eclipse collections. So, in a few hours, maybe we will reach the point of Java collections. But this was in one point we'll talk about that, right?
So, yeah, I would say like in the blog I cover like 40 years of history and probably a 10 to 15 minute read. But yeah, we'll get there in a few hours.
Is it orally, a blog or a book?
It's a blog. Actually, Medium tells you let's see what it's reports.
It's an old scroll, you know.
So if you go to donrob.medium.com, I blog prolifically. So I think I got like 200 and something, 270 blogs out there. But let's see, Joy of Programming. Donald Robb. And it is, it says it is a 10-minute read. So in 10 minutes, you can learn 40 years of history. You'll also see a neat picture. So remember I was telling you about Smalltalk is where I started to learn about programming history and the origins of things. So when I started programming professionally in Smalltalk and I got into Smalltalk, I started off at Blue Cross Blue Shield in New Jersey. Blue Cross outsourced their IT department to IBM. I became an IBM employee. At the time it was called
from the healthcare, right?
From healthcare. So I was still on an outsourced account. So I was still working in healthcare. It's just I was an IBM employee.
Okay.
And I got into the object.
And you learned Smalltalk because you had to, because of the job, right?
No, I learned Smalltalk because I had the opportunity to go learn Smalltalk. What I later did was I helped turn Smalltalk into a solution we used at work.
Well, don't tell me you learned it at the high school because you were already in university.
No, this was I was in IBM. I was in a place. So IBM had this, once again, program called Object Technology University. They had two tracks. One was Smalltalk, one was C++. And I had a choice. Okay. Either I could do Smalltalk or C++. I had already started to teach myself some C++. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, let me go to the small talk track because that's not something I felt like I could easily pick up. And it was I started out with a 5-week immersion programming program. And basically in 5 weeks in Atlanta at IBM's, one of their training centers, got to learn small talk, learn object-oriented analysis and design. And that completely just changed my view.
And was it good? Was it worth?
It was amazing. It's 8 hours in the classroom a day and like during the day. And I would spend, as many hours as they kept open the lab to actually do programming on my own. So I was
learn the most. So if you
heard exactly. It was the hands-on after the classes. Like I was learning concepts, but I was just putting them in practice. And I was like, this is incredible. Mm-hmm. So that was how I learned object-oriented programming. Later then, when I went back to work after the 5 weeks, actually Clipper had, because I was still maintaining some Clipper systems, I had Visual Object systems. Visual Objects was fully object-oriented. I now appreciated that better, what that meant. Clipper had an add-on, which we actually used. It was a library called Classy. It was actually class parentheses with Y, Classy. And Classy actually gave you full object orientation in Clipper, so you could actually define your own classes. They had four
built-in polymorphism? Could you have kind of an abstract class and subclasses in the database? Because this would be really interesting.
In Clipper? That I'd have to Google whether or not Classy support.
Because then magic happens, right? Because then the subclasses can have different behavior, and you read the superclass, and you can override, the methods in the subclasses, and then you have, how we called it back then, transparent persistence. So this would be, wouldn't be transparent because the object would be halved. The interesting part is, do you remember whether the objects were attached to the storage or detached?
Yeah. So according to AI, the Classy library for CA Clipper did not natively support abstract classes or pure virtual methods in the way modern object-oriented languages. So if we believe AI, I'll say it's probably not wrong. But it meant you could develop basic. I would say it was somewhat akin then in some ways to Visual Basic, right? Visual Basic didn't really have abstraction. You could define concrete classes, right?
Was Visual Basic object-oriented? No.
At some point it was. I had a period of my life.
.NET, everything was the same. So I remember as .NET came out, so C#, Visual Basic, and all .NET languages are almost the same. So this was crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I think Visual Basic, if I'm not mistaken, I did 6 months of Visual Basic 6 programming at some point in my career. This was after the Smalltalk. So by the way, you take a Smalltalk developer and forget throwing them into Java, throw them into Visual Basic, and they'll be miserable. Visual Basic 6. Because Smalltalk, for those that don't know, is like, it was like really the language, the creator of Smalltalk, his name was Alan Kay, he coined the term object-oriented. So Smalltalk was like a pure object-oriented language. It's like object-oriented the way, developers could only dream to have object-oriented supported. It was amazing.
So I remember a team of Smalltalk programmers develop application, and everyone was happy with the application, but the company policy was Java. So, and they were forced to migrate from Smalltalk to Java. They had no idea about Java, and I was supposed to help them. And they cursed Java because they were always missing were blocks. And I said, okay, what is a block? And they say, this is just a block. Why you don't have it in Java? I was like, we can have an inner class or a block.
You know what a block is?
Yeah.
And it's a lambda.
But they couldn't explain what a block is. And I showed them our block and they were not satisfied. It's like, I don't know what do you mean. But then we together, after a while, we built actually an interesting system. And what they did was crazy. They had, they built in their classes, inner classes like meta, and the class, there was meta class inheritance and class inheritance in Java. And for them, it was absolutely natural. And say, now Java is great. And they were happy. And I look at this. It's like, this was an alien technology, what you're building with Java. But everyone was happy. So, okay, let's go with it. And we stopped Link back then. So Toplink was Smalltalk, and Eclipse Link was so we used Toplink Eclipse Link back then. With polymorphism, and the object were attached to the storage, so it was a very thin application. In fact, we implemented the entire thing with budget was only dedicated for the documentation, so it was like remaining budget, and it still worked, and we had lots of fun still. So I never did anything with Smalltalk, but I'm really interested in it. I was a little bit disappointed how the IDE looked like, because they were really, they said, this is the best thing ever. And they showed me the workbench, and I was like, okay, the Visual H for Java looks better. It was Smalltalk based, you know?
I was going to say, Visual H for Java was actually implemented in Smalltalk. Yeah, exactly. And it looked nicer, right?
For them, looked really like ASCII text, I would say, right? Like beginnings of Swing, maybe. But what I understood is there is the IDE is the runtime, so you can just run it and see what happens. So this is why they were so productive, and they missed that in Java. So we use Eclipse back then, not Visual H for Java, rather than Eclipse already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because I may have mentioned in the Joy programming blog, I had actually gone from Smalltalk. I had done Visual H for Java. Visual H for Java was the very base first. Java IDE that I used, and it was familiar to me, you know, coming because I had done Visual H for Smalltalk. And later, when Visual H for Java stopped supporting newer versions of Java, and I think it made it as far as JDK 1.3, for anybody who remembers that far back, it didn't support 1.4. But that was when Eclipse came out, and I had to make a choice at this point in my career. I was working at Goldman Sachs, so I'd moved from healthcare to finance. And
why you moved, just because you wanted, or?
So interesting story. So I spent about 7 years, in healthcare, from like 1994 to 2000. I spent a year doing, I guess e-business consulting would be the category of work, but basically that was during the dot-com boom, which went boom. Then I had joined Goldman Sachs as an application architect, and was basically at this point doing Java full time. So I'd, you know, done a full transition. I went, you know, Smalltalk to Visual Basic to Java, and then to Java full time.
And how do you like Java? So you learned Java at Goldman Sachs or earlier?
I hated Java. It was horrible, horrible, you know, experience using this language. And
I learned Java after C++, and also hated Java at the beginning, because in C++ you had headers, and in Java you had interfaces, and for me it was like, it's a bit different, so it was not as clean. And what I really hated were the applets, because I couldn't understand the point of, you know, animated Duke. So okay, nice, everyone is crazy about the Duke, but why we need this in browser? I couldn't get, you know, the point, because It loaded for 3 minutes, and at the end of the day, there was an animation with a mascot.
Yeah.
And then, thankfully, I got the first server-side project, and then it changed everything. But at the beginning, it was, for me, was crazy times, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, because like the reason I say I hate Java is like, I was coming from a Smalltalk background. I was used to having, and this is actually the, you know, probably genesis story of Eclipse collections in some ways. Like I had very rich collections, and we had blocks, aka lambdas, and Smalltalk. And like this, you might find this interesting, a little bit of history. The Clipper language had blocks. So I've used lambdas since 1990. And the block syntax in Clipper was inspired basically by Smalltalk. The developers who worked on Clipper were fans of Smalltalk. And I didn't know that at the time.
So is Smalltalk older than Clipper?
Yes. Clipper came out in the 80s. Smalltalk started development in like the early 70s or maybe even late 60s. But I think the first version was...
Okay, my impression was the Smalltalk was maybe a little bit older than Java. That's that old? I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the first versions of Smalltalk were not publicly available. They were, you know, internal at Xerox PARC. But I think there was a Smalltalk 72 and 76. The first publicly available Smalltalk was Smalltalk 80. And that was the Smalltalk that, you know, a lot of developers got to learn. Then you had a bunch of vendors came up with like different Smalltalk implementations. IBM had IBM Smalltalk with Visual H, which is what was then used for Visual H for Java. There was a company that IBM, I think, was a subsidiary, I don't know if it still is, called OTI, which built they built this version control system, which was amazing for Smalltalk, called Envy. And it was actually what was used in Visual H for Java as well.
Yeah, and I had to use it with Java in Envy.
Yeah, so Yeah. So, you know, once again, interesting stuff. And this is why, you know, I was mentioning too, like, I've learned so much now about this, like, history, and there's so much history in computing. There's so many just different things people have done, right? It's like, we see this very limited view of, like, there's Java and Spring. No, there's a lot more in the universe that's happened. And, you know, you do encounter stuff out there in the wild, right?
So I saw a lot, and the reason being is because I was always often involved as a consultant in migration projects, or I had to work, you know, for all the enterprises. So you see just the stuff, right? So I saw the Envy, I see the green screens, I ask question, what is it? So I remember the name, I have no experience what it actually did, but it always had interesting conversations with the developers. I learned a lot. So what I try, you know, to learn is the concepts. What didn't work back then? Yep. What were the solutions? I remember recently, actually, they had a pattern in the DB2, in old DB2, and they called it, I think, group sorting. It's like what they did, they sorted by the second row, like AAA, BBB, CCC. And I found the same principle in NoSQL databases to store Java object hierarchies in DynamoDB, for instance. Exactly the same principle with different name. It's like, this is crazy. Or before image and after image. You know, if you had a JPA with optimistic locks, this is exactly what happens, you know. I really like, you know, the enterprise stuff because, I don't know, it was challenging but somehow easy. It was both at the same time. Like, for instance, the common transaction gateway to the host. You know, this was also interesting because it's two-phase commit and stuff. And an interesting name, common transaction gateway. And there were lots of overlapping concepts, maybe. So if you learn, you know, one concept, you can easily learn the others. So, yeah, interesting times.
It was.
Goldman Sachs with JDK, which one you started?
I had used JDK 1.3 at Goldman. We went to 1.4. So interesting, I guess, getting back to the genesis story of, you know, why would a Goldman Sachs employee create a Java collections framework?
Yeah.
Which actually happened in
2004. But we will discuss this next time because today it is mission impossible.
we've run out already.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is our podcast, but it's maybe too long. So, I interrupted you too many times because I also got idea with the clip and it was like overlapping, you know, experiences.
Well, it's funny because I had a great time just talking about it. Like, I haven't heard someone as interested as yourself, like, in this history of interesting stuff. So because, it's good to recall some of it.
Because, exactly. And if you know a little bit history, why we should repeat, you know, the same problems on the same failures or errors from the past, and this is why, if you know two-phase commit had problems, I'm pretty sure already someone would try with AI to wipe code and two-phase commit system because an agent will maybe say it is good to use two-phase commit, and if you know it is problematic or which limitations there are, so you can be faster, no. But I interrupted with something interesting with Envy, Visual Edge for Java, and Smalltalk.
Yep.
And then I interrupted you with whatever I said. So you wanted to tell me why you like the Visual Edge for Java and how Envy happened with repository, and then I interrupted you, and then interrupted you again with Goldman Sachs.
So what was interesting, I guess, with Envy, that something it had that just modern, you know, what we know now as Git version control doesn't happen. I would say, like, people can do it via practices more than Envy just did it naturally for you. Pretty much everything that you saved in Envy, we used to say Envy was like an elephant. It never forgot. So every time you save a method, it was immediately compiled in version. Well, not versioned. It was was called an addition was created. So effectively a version in the repository was created for you. So you had unlimited history of everything that you did at the method level. You could look at all additions of a specific method. So imagine it was like local history that you have in IntelliJ now, right? Where effectively you can look at it at the method level in a class. So you didn't, you weren't dealing with files. You were dealing with classes and methods. And like you had constructs available to you that really enabled for you, you know, to look at things and in I'm going to use
sounds almost like intended. Kafka.
Kafka. Mm-hmm. I have not used Kafka.
Kafka is it is sold as a messaging system, but actually it is a database. So how it works is
Kafka. Yes, you're sorry. I still haven't used it, but yes, I guess more familiar with it. So didn't click at first.
Basically, or Kafka is similar to Git.
Yeah.
It is like, you know, you have messages and you append only messages and you never delete actually stuff. But we had problems with Envy. There was an insurance, the entire insurance was on Envy. And in the end, they had some performance problems because, it was too big.
Yeah, those wind up being the problems, right? Where, you know, mm-hmm. It's a scale.
I hated one thing in Visual Edge for Java. I couldn't see the entire class. So the problem was you click on a method and you only saw the method and I cannot do this. So I would like to scroll and see everything. So I printed out the classes, I have to admit.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny. So it's interesting. And this, you know, probably for another time we can talk about, there were things that I missed in Smalltalk and that were in, I think I'm not sure if they were in Visual Edge for Java, to be honest. I can't recall. Smalltalk had this concept, which I forgot about for like 30 years, called method categories. Mm-hmm. And Java needs them, right? It's like, because what we do right now in Java is so imagine you could basically for a method tag that it belonged to a specific category, right? Mm-hmm. So, let's say you had methods that were like in a class that did filtering or methods that did grouping. Oh. You could tag them and say like, these methods belong to this category. And this was actually, mm-hmm. the ultimately inspiration that I followed in terms of the book that I wound up writing called Eclipse Collections Categorically. And what I did was I found a way to actually implement method categories in Java, but I'm doing it through IntelliJ, right? Where you can use custom code folding regions to basically take a scope of code, right? Where let's say you've got a bunch of methods in your class, so you can put a begin and end region, you know, mm-hmm. comment around it. And what IntelliJ will do automatically for you is actually put that into a tree view for you, mm-hmm. right? So instead of like, if you've got 150 methods in a class, instead of 150 things that you've got to scroll through, although if you like scrolling, then great. Mm-hmm. But you can then actually group them by the way you want to organize them in the class. So the mm-hmm. idea with Smalltalk and it wasn't, I would say, it's really up to a developer to do this. Like, if you wanted things to be easier to find because you couldn't just scroll to look for it, the way to do it would be to actually use method categories to, like, group things. So it's like, look for the group of things.
This is my experience, you know, 25 years ago, I guess I did this. Now maybe we're completely different. Maybe I will appreciate, you know, the reason that...
Well, I did not appreciate it 30 years ago when I first learned it, you know, 25 okay. years. So it's like up until recently, like, oh my gosh, like why have I been missing this? And I didn't realize this was so important, right? And it was really... Mm-hmm.
What they're doing with method is just an overview for during development time. You needed to find, you know, specific cohesive methods.
No, it really comes down to, it's like, it's about helping... developers not just find things, but to learn them, right? If you have, let's say, a collections framework that has a very rich API, or even Streams, let's say Streams has 44 methods on it, right? How do you learn 44 things, right? It would actually be, there's a natural thing called information chunking that humans benefit from, where we take things together and group them together, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So method categories allow you to do that, where like you can take that 44 methods and maybe have filtering, grouping, you know, testing methods, right? And then put things like any match, all match, none match into testing, or like things like contains. So it's like anything that returns Boolean maybe is a testing
maybe
method,
I have
right?
Even a small use case for that, because what I do right now is I use Java records as entities basically, and sometimes I put JSONP serialization, JSON serialization code on the records. And what I could do is category serialization, for instance, and category, I don't know, validation or business logic. So I can see by selecting serialization, all serialization related logic.
You
right?
can do that. Yeah. If it's,
okay.
That's exactly the
valid use case for that.
Yeah, anything that once again you want to be able to either filter,
basically,
pretty much. Okay. Since we don't have, and it's if I was to implement it in Java, it would be via tag, and I would use that for
annotation.
Both.
This would be source annotation. Right?
Exactly. So I would use it for JavaDoc, and I would use it for the IDEs to recognize it. Today, I use once again custom code folding region and IntelliJ to simulate method categories. But
why
then it means
annotations and IntelliJ go with annotations. Then it would be no.
Well, I have no way of changing the actual structure view in IntelliJ to recognize the annotation. Right? Yeah. I don't know. It would be nice if it was, once again, just built into the language, right? I feel like I shouldn't be defining my own, you know, language constructs and building ID around it.
As a JEP.
It should be. So it's funny because like I've shared this with, you know, folks who work on the, the core JDK team. So, and I think
and what
Stuart,
they said?
They actually think these are people I've talked to think it's a good idea. So I think Stuart Marks actually talked about it at DevOps Belgium in the Ask the Architect section.
And we covered Stuart Marks in all the punch tapes. How
Did
to?
You?
Yeah, yeah. So, nice. I mean, so we already see that we advance in our topics because there was no mentioning of punch tapes. No?
I did not do punch tapes. So
yeah, exactly.
Stuart's
so
got me beat.
Yeah, modern Java already. You know, this is the time after punch tapes. Because at the beginning, we had a chat with Punch Cards, and Stuart apologized and said, okay, we actually have to cover the Punch Tapes because he was wrong with Punch Cards. So we spent a little bit time on the podcast to discuss Punch Tapes and Cards. And Goldman Sachs, what is your goal? Always collections or what?
No, I worked in finance. I don't want to build a collections, you know, library.
Okay.
In fact, like I would say, like because we're at time of, you know, if we do another session, like what I would leave your listeners with is there's a blog I wrote called.
Of course.
there's always a blog.
That's the next 40 years.
So I wrote this blog called My 10-Year Quest for Concise Lambda Expressions in Java. So I started building Eclipse Collections in 2004, and it was a library that was inspired by my experience using Smalltalk, which had a very rich collections framework. So I developed a framework that needed lambdas in 2004, and I had to wait 10 years for it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is how I actually got involved in the JSR 335 expert group with Brian Goetz and company to actually get lambdas into Java 8. So I didn't want to build a collections framework. I just wanted the productivity benefits of having lambdas in Java with a collections framework. And it's like no one else was building it. I want to build it, right? And
the interesting part is, and it, I think it was the Java 1, you know, the old ones.
2014?
Pardon?
2014, maybe?
Yeah. And someone said, would like, you know, to meet Donald. And he and I said, who is Donald? Yeah, he created own collection framework. And I answered no.
Why would anybody do that?
I don't like to meet Donald who created own collection framework. Because back then I was in huge projects and everyone tried to inherit from list or whatever, and whatever I saw was really bad. And I say, okay, this guy is probably crazy. He created his own collection framework. And they say, yeah, it is going to be open source in Eclipse. And I say, in Eclipse? I go, no, I'm absolutely not interested in another collection framework. But with your background right now, I'm really curious because I already heard good things, what Eclipse collection framework can actually do and the ideas. And I have the suspicion we will need more than 1 hour just to cover maybe, I think blocks is already, you know, I didn't want to ask too much about blocks because night is short, you know. So I think the next time we should gentle start with blocks and maybe start with the collection, the collection framework. But what interests me, so you started just to code at Goldman Sachs and then you missed something, right? And what was the, and your job was just to implement calculations or what?
I worked on back-end, systems for calculating, let's say, P&L or doing regulatory reporting and stuff. So I went through I worked at Goldman for 15 and a half years and went through, you know, many years of just, once again, I was an internal developer at a bank. I didn't get involved in open source until...
But as an internal developer, you there was a complex code with calculations or bank stuff, not like CRUD, what I usually do, you know, database.
Well, no, it's funny because we had large database problems. We had large memory space problems. Actually, Eclipse Collections was born in a space where I was like dealing with like large Java caches where we built our own custom, you know, caching framework. And, you know, we were dealing with immense size memory spaces at the time where, and you can, you know, read about this in various places of, you know, blogs on my site where I talk about the constraints. And also I talk about this in the book because in the early days.
You mentioned a book. What book is it?
So it's called Eclipse Collections Categorically, and the subtitle is Level Up Your Programming Game. It's the story of basically the development, and then ultimately it's a comprehensive coverage of the Eclipse Collections API, which is a very rich, you know, collections framework. And it covers.
And you can order it right now. Is this
Yeah, it's up on Amazon or, you know, Barnes & Noble. You know, it's available on Kindle if you use that. Or if you don't use the Kindle device, there's the Kindle app. It's in the Kindle Unlimited program right now. So if anybody has Kindle Unlimited, you can read it for free. Free as in, you know, I mean, you're paying for Kindle Unlimited if you have
how
it.
How many pages?
In print, so let's see. The hardcover book is, I think, 377.
Okay.
I think the paperback one is 430, maybe.
And you're also describing the concepts, what like in the podcast, right? So like, you know, the interesting ideas.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, if you want to see what a collections framework would look like in Java, if Java had lambdas at the beginning, this is my view of what a collections framework, you know,
super interesting.
Look like.
I will buy the book actually after the show. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Really interesting. And I think, and now I got actually... Why you implemented collections? If I knew that back then.
Yeah. And actually what I could tell you as well, like you can read the preface for free on the online reading sample on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And actually I explain in the preface why I created Eclipse Collections and the problem was solving.
This is the cliffhanger.
You'll see that in 4 pages as opposed to taking over an hour for me to get to that point. But 4 pages to explain. And it was really what would be very interesting, maybe for a follow-up conversation. The key thing that got me developing collection containers themselves were I was solving memory problems in the 32-bit space that Java wasn't solving for me. I had to basically fit into, you know, at the time, large caches that were pushing the boundaries of 32-bit space. We could get up to, with 32-bit Java on Solaris, we could get up to 4 gigs of memory, right? So a bit more than obviously could do in Windows at the time. But like I had more space than more stuff that I could fit in that space. And collections actually wound up being one of the key problems I had to solve.
Google had similar problems, what I remember.
Did they?
Then.
Okay. Well, it's funny. Yeah, it's like pre-64-bit when, you know, memory was voluminous. But like, you know, I've always had this problem of dealing with memory as a constraint, but also like, it's funny, my two primary challenges in Java were like, memory was something that was causing me nightmares in my day job. The other thing that was causing me just agita and pain in my day job was like having to read for loops over and over and over again. It's like, I want a developer to tell me what they're doing, not how they're doing it, right? Yeah, so right. I got tired of, so it was basically a combination of memory and code duplication. Those
were
the key
things.
Yeah, but
the for loops, you hated the for loops just because you knew Smalltalk.
Yeah, I had experience.
I think because for me, for loops were not a problem. I remember as Java Streams came out, okay, a different for loop. I was not that impressed. Now I really like it, so I don't use for loops anymore. But
well, it's funny because once again, I don't have a problem with writing for loops. I've written plenty of them. In fact, you have to write them if you implement a collections framework. It was really once again just having to read them over and over again. It's like oh, I'm reading through all this code to see an if statement in the middle of a for loop to see if they're adding to a collection. It's like, oh, you're doing a filter. Or, oh, you're returning out of the if statement. Oh, you're doing an any satisfy.
Ah, it's an interesting point. So the Java collection framework is like condensed patterns into methods, basically, right?
Yeah, and so the key thing you get with Eclipse collections is, you know, with Java Streams, you've got, let's say, this lazy approach to doing stuff. And we have lazy approaches in Eclipse collections. Plus, we support streams as well because we integrate with the JDK types. But you have the actual rich methods like filter, map, and reduce with the... It's a different name in Eclipse Collections. It's called select, collect, and inject. For folks familiar with Ruby, it'd be more Ruby-esque, or if you know Smalltalk, you'd know where they came from. But the methods on the collections themselves. So you don't have to do dot stream and then terminal operation. Like they're eager on the method, on the collections themselves, which is like, if you're familiar with for loops, it's the closest thing you're going to get to a for loop because it executes immediately. Behind it is a for loop, right? Typically. So,
Then I cannot read the 4 pages right now, but my suspicion is that you had a big data problem and then you got the idea you need some kind of collection. And because you have to change things, you say, now do it right. And you want to add blocks from Smalltalk combined with for loop-less programming. So something like streams and then how collections happen. Then you combined the streaming with big data support and blocks, and this is almost like Java streams next, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because like you mentioned, like we anonymous inner classes for 10 years, I had to use anonymous inner classes to basically implement blocks, right? And it was, I call it an eye gouging experience, right? You see something, it's like, why didn't you just write the for loop? It would be simpler. And it's like, well, I wanted the abstraction.
Yeah, I also hate to say what inner classes. Yeah.
Well, and IDEs would actually fold out. You know, IntelliJ would hide, try and hide some of it for you, but it was still there. It's annoying.
Thank you. So next time we will cover blocks first, maybe Smalltalk, Clipper, and Java. So what's the difference? And what also surprises me that you like Ruby. I also wanted to learn Ruby. I like Ruby. I think, okay, it's interesting. And but never happened because Java was always still too popular. I have less interest somehow in Python. So if I would pick, you know, Ruby or Python, I don't know why. I just would just go with Ruby. I no idea why. It's just...
Well, put a pin in when I wrote my book, I used AsciiDoc and I used ASCII Dr. J and I used ASCII Dr. J is implemented in JRuby. So even though I haven't done a lot of, I have the Ruby book and did maybe some, I'm more familiar with the language than I have actually used it, right? And I'm familiar with like its lineage and I got to meet the creator of the language back at Uppsala in 2002. His name is Yukihiro Matsumoto or just Mats. But using JRuby, like literally over the last 3 years, has been amazing, and I've gotten to you know become friends with and, Charles Nutter as a result. So
and the ASCII Doctor is the, maintained by Mojave Linux is his handle on Twitter. I forgot is Dan. And the name we spent a lot of time with Dan because he was also early on Java E. So on all Java ones, we have long talks about Java E. Tommy and ecosystem, and yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, so fun stuff. Well, I'm looking forward to the next time we can talk. This was amazing. So thank you for the chat and the questions.
Yeah, thank you. And I will publish in a few weeks. And I'm really looking forward to whatever. So we can, you know, even recap Envy. It was interesting conversation. I learned a lot. But yeah, interesting stuff, you know.
You know who you need to have on your show to talk about Envy is Mike Milinkovic, who's the director of the Eclipse Foundation.
Mike Milinkovic was already on the podcast.
Did you talk about Envy?
I don't think so. So, but I can, because we talk about Jakarta E back then, Mike Milinkovic. And we had Tanya. She was also working for OTI. So I had lots of OTI people here on the podcast. So small world.
Yeah. Yep, good stuff.
Thank you a lot and see you next time.
All right. Thank you, Adam. Take care.